It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, ever wonder about some of the lesser-known characters who helped make history here in Wisconsin? Our guest shares some of the most interesting stories.
First, the Supreme Court ruled today that a religious school can use taxpayer funds for a playground. The ruling came in the case of a Columbia, Missouri church, which operates a daycare and a preschool as part of its church ministry. The church had been seeking funding for rubberizing its playground surface and applied for a state grant that excludes funding for religious institutions.
The case has implications beyond the playground. Dissenters say that giving a taxpayer-funded grant to a religious group is a slippery slope for the separation of church and state. Supporters say the church shouldn't be excluded from a grant it is otherwise qualified for.
The Supreme Court also made another major announcement that it will be reinstating parts of President Trump's travel ban. We'll have more coverage on that tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Right now, John McGinnis joins us to tell us more about the religious school case. He's a professor of law at Northwestern University. John, welcome to Central Time.
Delighted to be here.
Well, how did this church, Trinity Lutheran, make the case that the grant denial violated its rights?
By appealing to a very general principle under the Bill of Rights. There's a long time the court has held in many areas that the government can't condition giving you money on your giving up your constitutional rights. And so since you have a constitutional right to practice your religion, they can't condition funds that are generally available to anyone on your giving up those rights. In some ways, just as they couldn't do that by saying only Democrats could or Republicans could apply for some generally available program. So I think that's the central holding to treat the Free Exercise Clause like most other rights, at least for most purposes.
And this went against the rulings a couple in the lower courts. What were the arguments there when this case went the other direction?
Well, the arguments there were that there's some permission for instance, the government to to not give out money to churches to avoid the appearance that it's helping religion. That was one of the arguments. In other words, not everyone might understand that this was a general program and the Lutheran Church just had a better proposal, and they might think the government was helping religion. I think that argument, the court doesn't really deal so much with that argument, but I think the problem with that argument is that appearance arguments are essentially illimitable intrusions on the liberty. People can always say that there's some appearance that's a problem, particularly people who aren't really following public policy. And that's, I think, a problem if you actually want to protect people's rights rather than have them at the sufferance of other people's ignorance.
And you've said that you agree with the majority opinion in the Supreme Court. Why is that?
Yes, well, I think the Free Exercise Clause should be treated like other clauses. You should get the same kind of rights. Moreover, of course, in the modern world, the state is quite powerful in giving out money. And if it gives out only money to secular institutions, you're actually disabling and actually putting the thumb of the state you're not being neutral. You're actually making the state help secular institutions at the expense of religious ones, even when the religious ones are doing what civic associations often do, provide public benefits. So that I see would be a big cost of if the court had gone the other way.
Now, some have argued that it is in the public interest to fund religious institutions because, for instance, vulnerable populations may depend on them, thinking about instances like hospitals. Can you draw out the arguments there involved in a state funding to help a religious group for the common good and putting taxpayer money toward a religious institution?
Well, so long as they're doing it, I think it's very problematic if the state actually chooses to help particular religious institutions, just funds religious institutions. That's not what's going on here. But I think you're absolutely right. So long as the program is neutral, it can help poor individuals. I think the biggest effect of this decision is likely to be in the school voucher area. There are 39 states, I think 37 to 39, that have provisions that look something like Missouri's. And many state courts have interpreted these to prevent religious schools from receiving money or vouchers, even under neutral principles that would give them also to non-religious schools. So that's going to be the greatest change, and I think it will help poor individuals, because often having a greater supply of institutions that are willing to educate people, I think it is good, particularly for those who can't afford an education, because often religious institutions use some of their own funds to give a better education than the poor students could otherwise obtain.
Talking to John McGinnis right now, professor of law at Northwestern University, and we're talking about a Supreme Court ruling that would allow religious schools to use public funds in some cases. And looking at the dissent now, Judge Sonia Sotomayor wrote in her dissent that the ruling, she says, allows the government to tax its citizens and then turn that money over to a religious institution, thereby kind of chipping away at this wall between church and state. So do you see it that way?
Well, I guess I have several difficulties. First of all, there is no constitutional provision that says there is a wall between church and state. There is a constitutional provision that says there can't be a law respecting an establishment of religion. I think it's quite a stretch to understand this law as respecting an establishment of religion. It isn't focused on any particular religion or religions in general. It's a neutral law. So I don't think it does, quote, respect an establishment of religion. So just textually about the Constitution, she's wrong from the first point. But also I think the difficulty with her argument is that why, under that principle, can the state fund fire departments and police departments that actually protect religious institutions? That's going to be a benefit to those religious institutions as well. Of course, we don't object to it because, like the law at issue in this case, those laws are neutral. They don't actually single out religion for protection. That's why we don't think of them as an establishing of religion, and therefore I don't think they violate the Constitution. I think it's also just very sloppy language about separation of church and state. In some sense, church and state cannot be entirely separate, as the hypothetical about police protection and fire protection shows. It's really, I think, a metaphor that's a misleading and that can make people confused.
And other critics have worried that the ruling could legitimize discrimination. For instance, maybe restrictions on LGBT people who might not be welcome on a playground hosted by a religious group.
The question I think there is the state, I think, would be entirely open to the state to say that all of the playgrounds have to be open to people of all sexual preferences, because that law, the court has previously held that those laws don't discriminate against religion, again, because they're neutral laws. They're not actually focused on any particular religious belief. You could have a non-religious belief about not letting people of certain sexual preferences into your playground. So I don't think there's any danger of that the states continue to have the ability to condition their funds on neutral laws that may actually affect some people's beliefs, so long as they aren't targeted at those beliefs.
Now, you mentioned you thought the biggest changes would come in education. Do you see this as being maybe a bigger linchpin case than it might seem, and that it does pave the way for the use maybe of state vouchers for religious schools?
I do, and I think it's in two ways. One, for existing programs, I think it may do that. Many state Supreme Courts have interpreted their constitutional amendments to prevent that. Moreover, I think if you think about this in the political movement, I think there's going to be a much greater push for vouchers if some of the funds can be given to religious schools, because that will make those schools interested in lobbying their legislatures along with other private schools in doing that. So I think it's going to have a dynamic effect as well in pushing the, for want of a better word, the school choice program forward.
John, thank you for joining us.
Very, very welcome. Delighted to be here.
That was John McGinnis, a professor of law at Northwestern University, joining us today to talk about a Supreme Court ruling that would allow religious schools to use public funds in some cases.
We'll continue our coverage of the Supreme Court tomorrow at 4 when we look at the court's decision to reinstate parts of President Trump's travel ban. Right now, Wisconsin's history is full of quirky characters and great stories. A new book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press introduces us to 80 of them.
In Warrior Saints and Scoundrels, Brief Portraits of Real People Who Shaped Wisconsin, Michael Edmonds and Samantha Snyder bring adventures, politicians, mystics, and more back to life.
Michael Edmonds is Director of Programs and Outreach for the Wisconsin Historical Society. He joins us here in the studio. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, before we meet some of the individuals, what kind of stories are we looking for in this book?
Colorful, short stories, stories about strange people. Most people, when asked, say that history was boring. Well, history is not boring, and we were looking for people who exemplified colorful history.
And one of those, looking to the city of Milwaukee, some people may not know, it has a strong socialist history. I don't know if he qualifies as strange, maybe to today's political taste, but the election of Daniel Hone to mayor. Tell us about him.
That's a great comment, because he only seems strange in retrospect. He was not strange or very colorful in his time. He grew up poor, and he put himself through college and then law school and got himself elected city attorney in the early years of the 20th century. And those were the days when the corrupt political machines were being challenged at the state level by the progressives. But in Milwaukee, they were being challenged by socialists. And Hone quickly aligned himself with socialism in the city and became an ally of Victor Berger, whom many of your listeners, a name many of your listeners would recognize. In 1916, he managed to get a plurality of votes in a three-way mayoral election and became mayor for a quarter of a century. We think of Milwaukee today not as a very liberal place, but term after term after term, it elected a socialist mayor in the first third of the 20th century.
Of course, there's a bridge named after him there. What else would you say that would be his lasting legacy in Milwaukee?
Well, he was the first mayor to champion things that seem commonplace today, like public housing projects, a public bus system, public trash collection, things that we take for granted today as the normal things any municipality would do, had been under private control, and he was one of the leaders at the turn of the century in putting them under public control instead.
And he made a run for governor, didn't he? He didn't quite make it, though.
He did, toward the end of his life, just before World War II. And, of course, as your listeners will remember, after World War II, the state turned very conservative, and people with views like his really had no place at all on the political spectrum. He lived until 1961, but pretty much as a political outcast.
Now, that was one of the biggest names I saw in the book. A lot of the stories you tell are of names we probably haven't heard. And I want to turn to a piece of African-American history in Wisconsin, which people might think back to, you mentioned the book, the civil rights movement in the 60s. It goes way further than that. Voyageurs, the fur trade, there were people of African descent that early. And Stephen Bonga is a story you tell as an example.
Right. You're absolutely right. Ask most people about African-American history in Wisconsin, and all they can think of is the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. But in fact, there were black people living here long before there were any Yankees or Germans or Norwegians living here. And the Bonga family are among the earliest. Stephen Bonga's grandparents came in the 1780s as enslaved people with a British officer. And their son became active in the fur trade and moved across Lake Superior to where Duluth and Superior, Wisconsin are today, where he raised his family. And other fur traders and explorers were just astonished to find living in this Ojibwe village just upriver from Superior, a family of African-Americans. Stephen Bonga went west with fur traders and guided people through the Lake of the Woods and the Boundary Waters areas. He also went on the Sandy Lake Death March when the U.S. government tried to relocate the Ojibwe across the Mississippi and Minnesota and strand them there. So he had a very colorful history. And in fact, there are descendants still in Wisconsin today.
And aside from those descendants, are there any other traces of the Bonga family in northern Wisconsin?
That I don't know. I believe there's a lake in Minnesota named after the family, but I don't know about Wisconsin.
And he, again, African-American, he described himself, though, as the first white child born in Wisconsin, I understand, or in that area, because really he was the first non-Native American.
That's
born
right.
There.
That's right. He certainly got the irony involved in the racial politics of it more than 100 years ago.
Right now, we are talking to Michael Edmonds, Director of Programs and Outreach for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he's sharing some portraits of Wisconsinites that we might not know about. Warrior, Saint, and Scoundrel is the title of his book, and we're learning some of these hidden histories right now. And this is a name I didn't know, but when you talk about colorful stories, wow, Mary Ann McVain. Tell us about her.
She was a lumber camp boss in the 1870s and 80s, north of Green Bay. She moved out here from Maine and settled in the woods where her husband was nominally the boss of a logging camp. But she was the one with the personality and the character and also the physical size to keep lumberjacks in line. There were very few women in logging camps. In the 1870s, during the early phase of logging, there were some women cooks, but generally the only women around logging camps were nuns who would come out and try to cure the lumberjacks of their evil ways. But she ran camps outside Peshtigo and on the Wolf River with an iron hand. She was very compassionate and charitable and was remembered decades afterwards for her acts of goodwill. But when lumberjacks were unruly or didn't do what they were supposed to, she thought nothing about, as one of the memoir writers said, knocking them cold.
Right. She, like the nuns, was devoted to curing lumberjacks of their evil ways in some cases with a little more violence than a nun might have.
That's right.
I imagine.
One of the stories in the book is about a lumberjack who, just for fun, tied a rope to one of her chickens and kept throwing it in the river back and forth until it died. And she thought that was not just an abuse of her property, but cruel to the bird. And so she took this giant lumberjack and dragged him into the river and held him under many times in a row until he confessed to having done it and regretted it.
Quite a story there. And you also write about the Paul Bunyan legend in your book. And one person who's associated with that also gave us Wisconsin's mythical creature, the Hodag. What can you tell us about Eugene Shepherd?
Gene Shepherd was a timber cruiser and logging camp foreman all across northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. He even worked in the Pacific Northwest at one point. And everywhere he went, he told stories about a mythical lumber foreman, logging crew foreman of decades past named Paul Bunyan. Minnesotans like to think that Paul Bunyan was invented there, but in fact, that's where the Bunyan tales were popularized by marketers and advertisers. There was an oral tradition in Wisconsin logging camps that dates back to the middle 1880s, and Gene Shepherd is right at the heart of it all. He claimed to have invented Paul Bunyan just west of Rhinelander one winter, but he lied about so many things and plagiarized other people's works that you can't take anything he said for granted.
Well, he may not have invented Paul Bunyan, but speaking of Rhinelander, he did invent or discover
the Hodag.
But invent the Hodag.
invent. Lumberjacks had talked about this mythical, ferocious beast, the Hodag, for a generation, and Stewart claimed to have captured one, and so he exhibited it at the Oneida County Fair. It was in dim light, and he made it make noises through ventriloquists' techniques and charged admission to see it. After it was exposed as a hoax, people still came and paid to see it because it had been such a successful hoax.
What were they supposed to have looked like, Hodags?
Somewhere in between a wild boar and an alligator. And they were particularly hungry for novice loggers who hadn't been in the woods long.
Now, you say hoax. I'm looking at your book, and I'm looking at a picture right here. There's an actual picture of guys standing around the Hodag.
That's right, because because he was such a great booster and promoter, he had that picture taken and used as postcards to try to lure tourists to the Northwoods.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to close talking about another fellow I didn't know about, and I have to agree with some parts of what he's saying. He's saying, in essence, that Wisconsin is the promised land, is heaven on earth. Tell us about Reverend, what is it, David Van Slyke.
He was an itinerant preacher, a circuit rider, never ordained, who came to Wisconsin before the Civil War and settled in Trempealeau up in northwestern Wisconsin. And after reading the Bible 20 times, he concluded that the biblical Garden of Eden had in fact been located in Wisconsin, right there in Trempealeau, where the Mississippi and other rivers came together. He published a little tract, about 40 pages, about 3 by 5 inches, crudely printed and badly written, which he distributed everywhere he went, claiming that Wisconsin was where the Bible started. Only about, I think, 5 copies of this survived because it was so poorly made, one of which is at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we were delighted to find it and be able to write about him. If you go there today, you'll still see him celebrated in town.
Yeah, and even if his biblical scholarship isn't right on, I think most people can agree, Trempealeau, kind of a paradise in Wisconsin, metaphorically, if not literally.
And certainly has an ancient history. You know, the effigy mounds there go back 1,000 years, and before them, there's archaeological occupations even older.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That's Michael Edmonds, Director of Programs and Outreach at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He shared just a few of the many stories in the new book he's co-written with Samantha Snyder. It's called Warriors, Saints, and Scoundrels, Brief Portraits of Real People Who Shaped Wisconsin. First, in the 5 months since his inauguration, Donald Trump's presidency has had a rocky start. While there have been some wins for the president, including the successful nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, the White House has seen internal dissension, the Russia investigation, and presidential tweets getting in the way.
Our next guest says the president's team could learn lessons and turn things around, but that's only one possible outcome. In a new piece linked on the Central Time Facebook page, she lays out some other possible roads ahead for the Trump administration, from success to chaos and possible impeachment.
Elaine Kmark joins us now. She's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and author of the book Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Elaine, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you start that piece, Elaine, by saying, quote, Donald Trump's presidency is off to a very bad start, end quote. What are some of the key problems you've seen over the last 5 months?
I think that this is a president that doesn't quite understand the job or the Constitution or many other things that he's supposed to do. I mean, it's been erratic. He hasn't staffed his government. Usually presidents are quite anxious to get all their people in. He hasn't even appointed most of the people he's supposed to have. His policy making is haphazard. His messaging is contradictory. It's not just the tweets, which are extraordinarily distractive and have been very damaging to him, but it's the fact that the administration has trouble speaking with one voice. And a lot of that comes from the lack of discipline from the president himself. So this is an administration that's got a lot of problems.
And I know in your book, Why Presidents Fail, a big theme was they focus on image and messaging over the actual day-to-day work of governance. When it comes to weighing the Trump administration on that scale, how do things come out?
Well, I mean, my critique of most recent presidents, and it's a bipartisan critique because it's a critique of George W. Bush and Barack Obama, is that they spent so much time on messaging that they forgot to or they didn't give enough time to the proper implementation of their policies. And in the end, when the websites crash, when there are no weapons of mass destruction, when you fail, and guess what? You can't talk your way out of it. It's like a teenager crashing the car. You know, the dents are in the car. You can't talk your way out of it. Well, presidents, once they're president, they're evaluated on actually doing things and getting things done. And Bush, I mean, Trump, rather, has brought this to an entirely new level, because not only is he not accomplishing things, he doesn't have an infrastructure plan, he doesn't have a tax plan, he's bumbling around on health care and didn't lead on that, really followed the Senate. But his communication itself is chaotic and contradictory. So this is a president who's having trouble on both dimensions of presidential leadership.
Talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution about possible roads ahead for the Trump administration. In that piece I mentioned earlier, Elaine, you laid a few different paths we could take. Path number one, lessons learned either by the president or his staff. Trump and his team adapt. That's the most successful outcome you lay out. What would that look like?
Well, we see it from time to time. What it looks like is they roll out a piece of policy. There's a consistent message from the White House coming out. It goes to a team in the administration, and or it goes up to the Hill in the form of legislation. That's how normal presidencies work, and from time to time you see this presidency, you know, attempting that. But they've got a lot of trouble because they don't have capacity. And the president himself will do some things like that speech to Congress he gave a couple months ago, which got lots of praise. And so he'll do something and people say, oh, phew, he's actually...
Elaine, can you hear me? Lost Elaine Kmark for the moment from the Brookings Institution. We'll try to talk to her and bring her back on. Talking about a piece she wrote, we have this linked on the Central Time Facebook page, looking at possible roads ahead for the Donald Trump administration. Off to a very, very rocky start, she says, and she lays out a few possible outcomes from getting things together to possible chaos or even impeachment. Elaine, do we have you back?
Yeah, you got me back. I'm so sorry about that.
That's okay. These things happen. So you were talking about getting back on track. So what would make that happen? What is not happening that needs to happen? Who would need to lead that to get the Trump administration on track?
Well, somebody needs to work very, very closely with the president to keep him from either contradicting agreed upon paths that the rest of his government is doing, and to stop him from doing things that are counterproductive to his own presidency. I mean, the thing that's astonishing to me is that there is no evidence that the president was involved in anything to do with the Russians in terms of his campaign. Maybe some people around him were, but no evidence that he is. And yet he has consistently, by tweeting, he has consistently done things that make everybody think he's guilty. Okay, so somebody's got to say, you got to stop doing this. I mean, he shoots himself in the foot with some regularity, and that is not helping him to create an orderly administration that can get something done.
I guess a defender of the administration might say, well, we said that all through the campaign. He would say something that appeared to be a deal breaker for somebody running for the presidency of the United States, and somehow it worked out in the end. Is there a possibility that this is just a different style that could ultimately get good results?
Well, no, it's not, because campaign is only about words, right? A campaign is only about words and promises. A presidency is about delivering. And so if you can kind of get by with a chaotic and unusual campaign. If you don't deliver on what people expect from you, then you will have a failed presidency. And so far, their own behaviors are undercutting their effectiveness.
So that brings us to path number two. Path number one was people learn lessons, do better. The second one is no lessons learned and chaos and maybe a loss of presidential power. What does that look like?
Well, we're already seeing a little bit of this. I mean, if the presidency continues to be as ineffective as it has been, then what you're going to see is in different areas, you're going to see power move away from the American president. In international relations, we see a resurgence of China, and we see a resurgence in Europe of leadership from France and Germany. In areas like climate change, we see a resurgence of leadership from governors, particularly Governor Jerry Brown, who, after all, runs a state which, if it were a country, would be one of the biggest countries in the world. And so you see a resurgence of leadership from corporate America in climate change, of all things. And in healthcare and in taxation, I think we've seen, and I think we will see, a resurgence of leadership from the Congress. The Trump administration hasn't been very involved in the crafting of the healthcare bills. They don't know enough, and they don't have the capacity. So it's really been left up to the Congress to do it, and I believe that will be the case on tax policy as well. So if they can't sort of get a handle on the president's behavior and it builds some capacity in the White House, I think you'll see power move away from the White House and, you know, people kind of ignore them.
There have been complaints on the sort of constitutional balance of powers issue that the executive branch, the presidency, has had too much power, gotten too much power in recent decades. Big picture, would it be such a bad thing if Congress stepped up and got more authority?
No, not necessarily. Let's face it. This is the genius of American government, is the balance of power, so, and the separation of powers. So you've got three equal branches here, and it seems to be working pretty aggressively. The judicial branch has already stopped twice Trump's immigration policy, although today the Supreme Court gave him a partial win, and then they're going to consider it again. Congress has been really leading on health care, and I expect Congress will lead on tax reform as well. So it's not bad. You see other areas, and of course the judiciary is moving ahead with an investigation of Trump and his campaign and the possible Russian connections, and they're not deterred by the president, you know, insulting them all the time and insulting judges, et cetera. So, I mean, the balance of powers, the separation of powers, frankly, is working quite well.
We're talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution. She says the Trump administration got off to a rocky start and needs to adapt and learn from its mistakes or risk chaos or even, as we'll talk about in just a few minutes, possible impeachment.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the first half year of the Trump administration? What would it take to settle things down after some early trouble? Should the president change his leadership style? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Elaine Kmark is with us from the Brookings Institution. In a recent piece, she laid out some possible roads ahead for the Trump administration, everything from a successful adaptation after early problems to impeachment.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Trump administration will be able to navigate out of some early rapids? What would have to happen to make that happen? Should the president change his style when it comes to Twitter or stick with it? What are you watching for in the ongoing Russia investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Elaine, so far we've looked at lessons learned, things get better, lessons not learned, chaos continues. And then the third option, you look at a couple different paths here, possible removal from office.
Yeah, there's two ways you can remove a president from office, according to the Constitution. The first, of course, we know about impeachment, and it is clear that there is some grounds on obstruction of justice. And again, this has come out of the president's own mouth. I mean, this isn't even the result of an investigation, because he has admitted to, you know, wanting to get rid of Comey because he thinks the Russia investigation is just, you know, a mess and a political move out to get him. So there's clearly, you can clearly make a case for obstruction of justice, and that, of course, is why we impeached Richard Nixon, or why he resigned right ahead of impeachment. And so it's a very serious charge, and he seems to have walked right into it. Now, you know, the fact is that he did so publicly. I mean, Richard Nixon knew what obstruction of justice was and tried to hide it. The fact that Donald Trump did it so unbelievably publicly, it kind of makes people think, well, maybe he didn't really know what he was doing. Maybe we can't impeach him. Maybe he shouldn't be impeached because he was just naive about this. So that's one possibility. And, of course, what we don't know is if there will be a smoking gun in the Russia investigation. In Watergate, people thought that the Nixon campaign had been up to some pretty shady behaviors, but it took 2 years to prove that Nixon himself had been aware of those and had sanctioned the cover-up. We don't know that Donald Trump has been guilty of anything to do with Russians, and so until we know something more about that, I don't think this will get very serious. The other path to removing a president is very unusual. It's the 25th Amendment. And, of course, it was written in for those instances when a president is incapacitated and can't fulfill his duties. I mean, if he's having a gallbladder operation and is, you know, under anesthesia, he obviously can't be president for those hours during the operation and afterwards. But the question, there is, in fact, a further piece of that, which is incapacitation that is voted on by half the cabinet and then goes to the House and Senate, where two-thirds of the people had to vote that he can't fulfill, he's not capable of fulfilling the job. You know, this has been batted around because, after all, we saw at the end of Ronald Reagan's term, we saw the beginning of Alzheimer's. We didn't know it then, but now looking back, it's clear that he had some early Alzheimer's. He had a very talented wife who was very close to him and politically savvy, who stood by him and whispered things in his ear and basically covered for him until his term was up. So we never really kind of put it together at the time. But, you know, people who become president tend to be older. Older people get a lot of illnesses. I'm one of them. And various, you know, things go wrong. And so it is entirely possible that some of this chaotic behavior on the part of President Trump is an indication of something worse, in which case the 25th Amendment would become a vehicle for his removal. Both the impeachment and the 25th Amendment are kind of extreme and very, very unusual, but they have been talked about just because this presidency has been off to such an unusual and chaotic start.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I was born in 1961, and I grew up during the Watergate era, where tapes in the White House brought the downfall of Richard Nixon. And friends of mine at work mentioned that previous presidents probably had recording devices. John F. Kennedy probably had one, and I don't know who else they mentioned, but the White House belongs to us, the people, and I am just stunned that we have to rely on Donald Trump's word that there were no recordings made, whether digital or analog or whatever, of him and Matt Flynn. And couldn't we ask Mr. Obama, former President Obama, if when he left the White House, was he aware were there recording devices there, whether tapes or digital? I mean, this is just baffling to me that we have to rely on this reality show clown.
Ray, thanks for the call. I want to get Elaine in on this question of President Trump alluding to possible tapes and then saying recently, no, I didn't make tapes. I know of no tapes, but maybe there were tapes. And the transparency as to whether there were any kind of tapes. So what do you make of all that?
Well, remember that the special prosecutor has subpoena power, and he will be able to get to the issue of whether or not they are tapes. If there are tapes, the special prosecutor will get them. What broke open Watergate was the Supreme Court saying that Nixon had to hand over his Oval Office tapes. Now, the decision to tape a president is the president's decision, okay, whether or not to have this installed in the White House. I know Lyndon Johnson had tapes in the White House, and, of course, Richard Nixon did. But it's not an automatic thing. Do you know what I mean? It's not presidents don't go into the Oval Office and be required to tape everything. So I don't believe that President Obama had a taping system. I think this is up to the individual president. Nixon wanted to have an account for history. And, you know, and Nixon did a lot of really historic, important things. But in the end, it was the taping system that proved that he knew about obstruction of justice. He had ordered the obstruction, and that's what got him removed from office.
Ray, thanks for the call. Go next to David in Duluth. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm going to say right off the bat that anyways, if you want my opinion, is that Mr. Donald Trump needs to be impeached or the 25th Amendment be brought up. But I want to point this out to you, ma'am. I believe, even though most of the people out there in this country don't believe that even our Democrat, mostly all the Republicans in the Senate or in the Congress will ever touch him.
Gotcha, David. It is a tall order for a Republican Congress to impeach or vote for the removal of, via the 25th Amendment, a Republican president, Elaine.
Oh, the caller is absolutely right. Dave is his name.
Yes.
Is absolutely right. It is a tall order. It is very difficult. And frankly, it's not just that it's controlled by the Republicans. It's that removal of a president from office is a very, very serious step, especially when, you know, he was elected by the people. That's why we have to just be patient and let this investigation go on. The investigations like this can go in all sorts of different ways. And we will just, there's subpoena power, there's grand juries working on this, and I think we will know. It may take as much as a year, it may take a year and a half, but I think we will know whether or not there was any wrongdoing affecting that the president was involved in that rises to the level of impeachment.
As we wrap up, Elaine, staying with those Republicans in Congress, given that as you're describing things, leadership isn't coming from within the White House to right the ship here. Are there things that leaders, Republican leaders in Congress, could be doing to help make a more successful presidency?
Well, I think that what's happening is that Mike Pence, the vice president, is spending a great deal of time with the Republicans in Congress. He has an office not just in the Senate, but in the House of Representatives. He is campaigning every weekend practically for Republican members. And so I think, and when he has gone abroad, Mike Pence has clearly led a more traditional American foreign policy than the president has. And so I think that the righting of the ship of state, if you will, if it's going to happen, I suspect it will happen under the leadership of the vice president. And, you know, maybe that'll get us through the next couple of years.
Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Elaine Kmark. She's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, author of the book Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Been talking about possible roads ahead for President Trump's administration after a rocky start. You can read more. We have a link to a recent piece that Elaine wrote. It's over at the Central Time Facebook page. You can give it a look and share your thoughts on the topic as well. Again, that's on the Central Time Facebook page.
Welcome to Hogwarts. Now, in a few moments, you will pass through these doors and join your classmates. But before you can take your seats, you must be sorted into your houses.
by the Sorting Hat, of course. Well, that was Harry Potter's Welcome to the Magical Academy of Hogwarts. And it was 20 years ago today that the reading public was welcomed into Harry Potter's world.
On this day in 1997, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone was published in the UK. It was named Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, published in the United States. And it seems to have done okay since then.
I think it's safe to say it did okay.
I'm no expert.
And you, well, to be fair, you haven't read the books.
So I read the first
you're
one.
Kind of a muggle.
I read the first one.
I've read the books, therefore I'm of the magical world.
I've read them twice.
Have I read them? I probably have. No, at least once I've read them. They're so good.
I like the first one fine, and I've watched a random assortment of the movies I didn't watch beginning to end. My kids have read them all and watched them all, though.
I hope so, and I hope you will follow suit, Rob, because you're missing out. It's not just a story. It's... you know, a cultural phenomenon. And it's a way of life. Absolutely. It's all those things. And I can't wait for tomorrow on the show when we're going to talk about the Harry Potter phenomenon 20 years out and also hear your memories about when you discovered Harry Potter and what stayed with you.
20 years of Harry Potter. We'll talk more about that tomorrow here on Central Time.